interesting feedback and complimentary comments in the last lecture. I thank you very much. For those of you who sent in critical comments in the last lecture, I hope you die of peace today. Fortunately, that wasn't actually any of you. I got a lot of silence, but no actual criticism.
Thanks. So today I want to do two things differently. The first thing I want to do is, instead of going over, on the one hand, very almost philosophical questions about probability, and on the other hand, the differences between Bayesian and frequentist approaches to probability, I want to talk about more concrete applications and consequences of probability and uses. And I want to try to bring, at least by the end of the lecture, these two notions closer together. I'm not going to tell you that they're the same, but I am going to show you how they work together. And I'm going to try to conclude with some inspiring quotes that imply that maybe one day there will be world peace, or at least in statistics departments, there might be peace. Because you'd be amazed at how these statisticians go at each other. I mean, it's like hockey, but without pads. The other thing that's going to be different is, last time, I got so excited about preparing my notes that I didn't really prepare slides. Well, this time, I got so excited about preparing my mind that I didn't even prepare notes. Well, actually, I did prepare notes, but I didn't prepare any slides at all. So I want to try a total experiment. And this is something that I've seen instructors do in the past, and I've absolutely despised it, which is you put your notes up on the screen and you read off of them or you talk at them. So my hope is that by sheer force of personality, I can overcome the horribleness of this procedure. So I honestly do welcome feedback, really, seriously, at the end of the day, about whether you think it sucked, or in which case you're going to die of douche, or it wasn't that bad, or it worked, or whatever. At least these are not those horrible handwritten and then scanned in notes that I've seen some people do. You've ever seen Terry Rudolph give a talk? He loves to give these talks that he scrawled the night before on his tablet, and it's like really cool and modern and stuff, and I absolutely hate it. So, do we have a hockey stick here? Yes, we do. Excellent. No questions. So, as I said, first question, can those of you in the back read this okay, or should I make it bigger? Good? Comments, dead silence? Can you read it? One step bigger? Cool. How's that? All right. You know, maybe. It's Firefox. Anybody know how to make Firefox go full screen? What was that? Yeah, I don't think that's going to work on a Mac, although I could be wrong.
Try the window menu.
I don't think so. Ooh. Get rid of these. I think that's about the best I can do, honestly. I can get rid of the fine toolbar. So, maximizing screen real estate. All right. So the idea is here that I recommend listening to me as opposed to reading the screen, but I'm going to point at certain things as I go along, and you might want to notice those. So, okay, last time I spent all of this energy explaining what was different about frequentism and Bayesianism, and furthermore, I spent a lot of time knocking on frequentism. And then I come back today and I tell you that we're all going to be happy, bunny. We're all going to get along. And if I was you, I would be saying, how can this guy spend an hour and a half abusing frequentists and then expect us to all get along? Why is he going to come back and tell us that this is a good thing? Well, here's an analogy. Suppose this is a mechanics class, and I come in and I tell you, we're going to study the world, mechanics, how it works. There's classical mechanics and there's quantum mechanics. Classical mechanics is wrong. Here's a bunch of experiments, thank you Planck, thank you Einstein, that prove that classical mechanics is wrong. There's a bunch of recent results dispel inequalities, contextuality, that prove that it's really wrong. Then I come in the next day and I say, so, F equals ma, let's talk about Newton's laws. You think, this guy's out of his mind. But you've been in this situation because you've taken quantum mechanics and you've taken analytic dynamics, and you know what the answer is. The answer is, first of all, Newton's laws in classical mechanics reflect something deeply true about the world. The principle of least action is not something to be trifled with. It will mess you up. Furthermore, it's really a great approximation, and man, is it easier to solve certain problems with classical mechanics than with quantum mechanics. You know, balls flying through the air. You try doing the quantum mechanics of 10 to the 21st atoms. Or you could just say, yeah, it's basically a point particle, Newton's laws, F equals ma, parabola, yada, yada. I have the same view towards frequentism. First of all, in so many cases, it works quite well for practical problems, and it's a lot easier than Bayesian methods. Secondly, it's not wrong. It's no more wrong than classical mechanics is wrong. It's merely that it's not a foundation on which you can build, in my opinion, the ontology of probability, the what is probability. Because when you start trying to get very, very picky about the mathematical definitions, things start to fall apart. But almost everybody is naturally a frequentist. If you go to somebody on the street, if you go to a physicist on the street, and you ask them, what are probabilities about? They'll say something that involves relative frequencies. There's an idea of an inherently random event. And at the beginning of virtually every paper on probability theory or on data compression or on statistical inference, you'll see somebody say something like, suppose that we have a probabilistic source, blah, 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 with these probabilities. These sort of things are very hard for a Bayesian to even say. I'll talk in a minute about how a Bayesian says these things. But it's awkward. It's like trying to write your dissertation without using the letter S. It's possible, right? You could replace every instance of the letter S with the thing that comes before T. But you'd be a total tool if you did it. It's a waste of time. So for this reason, there's a lot to be said for being comfortable with frequentism, in the same way that we're all comfortable with the real numbers. Please raise your hand if you don't feel on a daily basis like you're comfortable with the real numbers. Okay, there are a couple of mathematicians in the room. Good. Physicists, by and large, are embarrassingly comfortable with the real numbers. We throw around e and pi and 2 on a daily basis, even the square root of 2. If you study the mathematics of the real numbers, the first thing you learn is that the natural numbers are a pain in the neck. I skipped my cool turtles all the way down figure here. I wanted to point out that if you believe in hidden variables, which by the end of this semester you may or may not, but at least you'll know what it means. If you believe that underlying quantum mechanics there are hidden variables, then basically what you're saying is that, well, yeah, there's classical mechanics, and then there's quantum mechanics, which underlies classical mechanics. And for instance, the principle of least action, which is the bedrock of analytic mechanics, is really just an effective approximation to a Feynman path integral, where you say, there's all of these paths, and the ones that aren't stationary action cancel out. And you do saddle point approximations in field theory and this sort of thing to say the principle of almost stationary action, basically. Well, if you're a hidden variables guy or girl, then you're implicitly believing that underneath all the quantum mechanics, there's some rich, complex, classical structure that probably obeys a principle of least action. Maybe not. Maybe it obeys something totally different. But if so, then underneath the principle of stationary action is a principle of least action for the hidden variables. Of course, who knows what underlies that? Maybe something else underlies that. Therefore, where do we stop? It could be turtles all the way down. Actually, it's sort of alternating turtles, right? Quantum classical. The point is that don't rule out an effective theory, necessarily, unless you are absolutely certain about what underlies it. And we are not absolutely certain about what the rightest theory of probability is. That was my turtle story. So back to numbers, real numbers. We're comfortable with them. If you start trying to define the real numbers, the first thing you do is you start trying to define the natural numbers, which are about the simplest possible thing.
Your average third grader has no problem with the natural numbers. 1, 2, 3, 4. Ha, 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 I am the Count on Sesame Street, right? I have a 1.5-year-old. She just graduated from Elmo to Zoe, and I expect that the Count will be coming soon. If you take a math class at university, then you find that, first of all, you need about 30 pages of set theory, just to understand the empty set. And then you can start defining the natural numbers. 0 is the set containing the empty set. And then 1 is the set containing 0 and the empty set. And 2 and blah. And you've got this giant construction of nested brackets. And you start thinking, I didn't mean to take a Lisp course. What happened? Sorry. Okay, thank God somebody got that. And why are there all of these brackets wandering around when all I wanted to do was count? The answer is that, you know, your third grader says, well, I mean, come on. I've got 1 cookie, 2 cookies, 3 cookies. Duh. Natural numbers are piles of cookies. Easy. And Bertrand Russell comes along and he says, so what you're telling me is that natural numbers don't exist unless cookies exist. It's not the point. But if you want to convince yourself that the natural numbers exist, and you start by only being certain that there exists a set, which I think is the first line of Principia Mathematica, then you end up building up the natural numbers like this. It's convoluted, it's complicated, it's counterintuitive, but it always works. So, I obviously don't have time to give you a complete and convincing tour of frequentism and Bayesianism. Judging from the emails that I got, which I will respond to, and I'm sorry I didn't have time to reply to some of those very carefully crafted and extremely long emails last night, there are some of you who would like to mount a last-ditch defense of frequentism. Great. Please do. It's not wrong. But what I found when I spent a couple of years exploring it was that at the bottom of it, I found it unsatisfying. It didn't have the kind of bedrockness that this does. Whereas the Bayesian approach is solider. It ain't perfect. It doesn't rely on nothing but, quote, there exists a set, but it's better. So, do your own investigation. If you want to be a frequentist in day-to-day life, by all means do. Most of us are. But one of the things that I want to tell you today is some of the pitfalls that can happen and why, at the end of the day, a really rich theory of probability and statistical inference almost has to combine the two of them. So, here's a quote from something that's not even published yet. So the authors probably wish that they hadn't given me a free copy, because here I am spewing it all over. This is an article by Lucien Hardy and Rob Speckens on the foundations of quantum mechanics, something that some of you may be interested in. And they comment that just as understanding how to drive an automobile is different from understanding how it works, or how to fix it, or how to build an automobile, so too is there a difference between understanding how to use quantum theory and understanding what it means. You could easily take this paragraph and just substitute in probability theory. So the point of these lectures is really to talk about what probability theory means and not just how to use it. That said, if you went to your mechanic with your broken car and he said, I don't have a driver's license, would you be worried? Would you ask, why don't you have a driver's license? I mean, I can think of two reasons. One, doesn't know how to drive. I'm a little worried about a guy taking care of my car who doesn't know how to drive. The other possibility is he got it taken away, and then I really want to know what happened. Was he, you know, DUI with clients' cars or something? Some of the statistics that is perpetrated on the physics community by physicists is, frankly, DUI with clients' cars. So I want you to come away from this week with some interest in and understanding of the foundations of probability. But if you don't come away with some clue about how to use probability, then I will take this hockey stick and I will be forced to beat either you or myself. I'm not sure which, because we will have failed. So let's talk about how to drive probability theory. If you want to drive probability theory, then you need to know the rules of the road. This is itself almost an interpretation of probability theory. It's the agnostic interpretation. It's the shut up and calculate interpretation. It's the I don't care what it is, I know what it does put the key in starter up. This, the axiomatic approach to probability theory, is purely mathematical. It says, we're going to do math. The fact that it happens to apply to everyday life and to physics is another of those great mysteries of life that I, as a mathematician, really couldn't give a fig less about. Wigner commented on the unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics in modeling the physical world. Physicists take this for granted. They say, the math works. Of course the math works. Wait, why does the math work? I don't know. Let's have a beer. Mathematicians say, there's a physical world. News to me. Have you guys know Grigori Perelman, the guy that solved the Poincaré conjecture? Have you seen the pictures of this guy? If you saw him at a conference, you'd expect him to ask you for money or be carrying a paper bag with a bottle in it. Wow, talk about a guy who doesn't appear to believe in the physical world. Bloody brilliant, but still. Okay, so Kolmogorov, another Russian guy who was, in fact, substantially less sketchy-looking than Perelman, though equally smart, decided that he was going to do this purely mathematically. And so he sat there and he thought about probability theory for a while amidst all of his other extraordinarily badass mathematical stunts. And he said, all right, I can boil this down to a ridiculously simple set of axioms, which is what you do in mathematics, of course. So, if you don't know the foundations of probability theory, put on your crash helmet and prepare to learn them. First, there are three background assumptions. These aren't even axioms. These are just statements about sets that, if you haven't had multiple semesters of measure theory, you might need to have these pointed out to you. First statement is, okay, we're going to talk about the probabilistic theory of some system. Fine. Or some effect, some phenomena. So there's going to be a set omega. Its elements are called elementary events. It's a set. It has elements, right? And this is called the sample space. Intuitively, but not rigorously, the elements of this space are sort of the things that can happen, the things that we assign probability to. I said not rigorously. So let sigma be a set containing subsets of omega. The elements of sigma are events. These are the things that can happen. They're the things that we're going to assign probabilities to. And finally, let there be a function that I will call per, just because F was already taken. And this is a function. You know what? The hockey stick just isn't working. I'm a fingers guy. This maps every element of the set of events into the interval 0 to 1. So this is a function that assigns a real number, something that looks like a probability. It's between 0 and 1 to each event. You can actually relax. You can just let these be real numbers. And then the axioms will be enough to constrain them. This is called a probability measure. And it is, in fact, a measure. Okay. What I just defined is called a probability space. It's the mathematical thing that does probability, if it satisfies Kolmogorov's three axioms. So the first axiom, for every event, the probability of that event has to be greater than 0, greater than or equal to 0. The second is, implicitly, one of the subsets of the sample space that can be found in the set of events is the entire sample space. And it has to have probability 1. So the first means that every probability is non-negative, and the second says something has to happen. And the third is really, this is where all of the math is. It says, for any countable union, this could be a finite union, or it could be a union indexed by the natural numbers, going to countable infinity. For every union of events in sigma, the probability of that union, that is a new event that has to be in sigma. So sigma has to be closed under countable unions. The probability of the union of those events is equal to the sum of the probabilities of the events. Roughly speaking, union distributes over probability if all of the E sub k's are disjoint, if none of them are overlapped. Sorry?
Intersection.
Yes, thank you. That's supposed to be the other way around. Cap, cup, typo. That turns out to be enough to derive all of probability theory. So a couple of comments on that. This third axiom is important. The others are kind of obvious. From this, you can derive various nice, if still intuitively obvious, things, like the probability of the empty set has to be zero. Just as the probability that something will happen is one, the probability that nothing will happen has to be zero. Also, suppose you have two events, right? These are sets of elementary events, and one of them is strictly a subset of the other. E is within F. Then you can derive that the probability of E has to be less than or equal to the probability of F. So this allows, this very simple framework allows you to build up all of probability theory. I would love to explain how we do that and how to read a paper written by a probabilist and make sense of it just using these axioms. And if you gave me two semesters at 3 hours a week, I could probably do it. But I can't. So now we're going to take a giant leap from giving you the foundation, so at least you know where it came from, to actually applying it. And when I apply it, I'm going to really do the same thing as von Mises did. And I'm going to say, we're not going to need the mathematics. It's going to be fairly obvious what we're doing. But I'm going to tell you up front that I'm BSing you. It's just that, in fact, if you were to work through it, what I'm saying would make sense. Whereas I think what von Mises ended up saying didn't. But hey, that's just my opinion. Okay, a couple of comments before we go on and start applying this handbook of driving. The first is that Kolmogorov's axioms are kind of a little bit more counterintuitive than you might have expected. For instance, why do we have this sigma business? Why do we have this set of events? Couldn't we just assign probabilities to the original set? That is correct. Let me give a little bit more detail about that. First of all, if your sample space is finite, then everything is totally simple and straightforward, and there's nothing to worry about. Probability works exactly like you would expect, and there is no reason that you cannot just assign probabilities one by one to each of the elementary events. So if a set in your mind is a bag with rocks in it, good. You can assign probabilities individually to every rock, not just to subsets of the bag. And the subsets of the bag get their probabilities, their measures, in the natural, obvious way by adding up the probabilities of all the elementary events. It's worth noting, though, that you don't have to have that. You can easily define a sigma that contains only subsets with more than one elementary event in them. So Kolmogorov allows you to construct probability spaces where no elementary event gets a probability assigned to it. And that's your right. Just by, for instance, you could say, OK, here's my sigma. It contains the empty set, and it contains all of omega. That's it. That set is closed under union and intersection. And I can assign probability 0 to the empty set and 1 to everything. I'm done. It's not a very interesting theory. But the whole point was to allow us to construct anything, including phenomenally boring theories. More interestingly, you have cases where every elementary event has zero probability. I know you know this one. Anybody else want to give me an example where this would happen? Are there any physicists in the room? Where would you have it? A non-trivial, non-stupid theory where every single elementary event has probability 0.
Position of a particle?
Yeah. Position of a particle. Why?
Because the integral over the integral from 0 and the bound is the same. It's like this.
Because, so the key word here is integral. Because the position is thought to be a real valued quantity. And so, even if my particle is bound between, say, x equals 0 and x equals 1, let me go ahead and assign a probability function. I'm going to assign uniform probability over this interval. It's the sort of thing that, as physicists, we write down on a fairly regular basis. So what does it mean? Well, it means that my omega is equal to the interval from 0 to 1, which is a subset of the reals, And it means that sigma contains at least intervals between A and B, where A and B are between 0 and 1. No, sorry, I should write on the other side. The set of intervals is not closed under union and intersection. So suppose that I close that set. Then I get basically combinations of intervals. And I can assign probabilities to any of those. For instance, to this interval, I'd assign probability 1/2. To this interval, I would assign probability 1/2, et cetera, et cetera. So the probability of an interval is proportional to its total length. So what's the probability of any given individual number? What's the probability that you observe x equals 1/3? 0. There's uncountably many in there, which means that the countable union business, the countable additivity, tells you that you can never add up countably many individual real numbers and get the entire set. And as a result, it's okay to have them all have zero probability, because if you add up zero countably many times, you still get zero. But that's okay, because you never get to the whole set. So in fact, this probability measure assigns zero to every countable subset of points. Furthermore, it immediately follows that just because the probability of something is zero doesn't mean it can't happen. This is really kind of a headache inducer, right? You really want to say, oh, zero probability means that you know, it won't happen. But suppose I take this system and I sample from it. What do I get? What do I get if I make a theoretically ideal measurement of the position? Somebody. I get a point. I get some number. Maybe I get, you know, to finite precision, but I get some number, like 1/3, which had probability 0. If you sample again, you'll get a different number. So really what probability 0 means is it means you'll never get it twice. But it doesn't mean you won't get it once. I find just kind of weird and cool, and one of those things that's worth, you know, rolling around in my head when I'm sitting on a bus. Final comment. Yes?
This phenomena you're describing, does that actually require an uncountable number of events? Like,
yes.
Like, if I have an infinite but countable number of events, like, for instance, if I have a machine which just spews out balls with, like, my machine starts numbering the first ball 1, the second ball 2, and just shoots them out, and I wait an arbitrary amount of time and then select a ball, the probability of selecting a ball with any particular number is 0, right? Although I only had a countable event set. But if I selected an even number, then I have a non-trivial, I have roughly probability 1/2, at least in the limit as time goes to infinity, right? So what's, but we didn't have an uncountable number of events there.
So the short answer is, it depends on how much you allow yourself to do with limits as time goes to infinity. And whether you allow the uniform, you know, an invariant measure over the infinitely large set. If you do, then yes, you can have I am not 100% sure what the resolution is. The problem is, if you say, well, they each have zero probability, then you have the problem that you can build all the natural numbers by countable addition, countable union, right? And so now you have a contradiction. You can't assign them finite probability, but you also can't assign them zero probability.
Right, but that seems more like a problem with the axioms than a problem with, like, the example I gave, right? Like, physically, in principle, I could set up an experiment like that.
Physically, the universe will die of heat death before you get to infinity.
Yes.
So it's pure, anything involving infinity is purely a mathematical question, right? So you have to ask what its status is in the axioms. as was pointed out earlier, if you do have uncountably many, then necessarily, well, sorry, not necessarily, under certain pretty reasonable assumptions, plus the axiom of choice, you can explicitly construct sets, you can describe sets that cannot be given a measure. Their measure must be ill-defined. They're not even measure zero, right? It's not that their probability is zero, it's that any choice of probability for them would be contradictory. And so they have to be ruled out of your sigma entirely. And even in this situation, you can get it. So I think it would be fun to spend 20 minutes discussing and thinking about the problem you brought up, but I'm not going to do it right now. Sonia. Not really. There's two questions. First, can you measure to infinite precision? Second, can you build a measuring device that reads out to infinite precision, even if its answer is not perfectly accurate? So if nature is discrete, then I can't even do the latter, right? Any measuring device basically is chopping up the real line into little itty-bitty chunks. Now you have a countable set. But you could also divvy it up into events that are of width 1/8, let's say. Maybe that looks like 1/10. But there's uncountably many of them, right? Because here's another event. So my events can be overlapping. And so I can still have uncountably many events without any implication of infinite precision. All I have to have is a measuring device that's capable of reading out a real number. And you can imagine that your measuring device just keeps on churning out bits, but at some point, those bits become random atmospheric noise. And then we start getting into very complicated discussions about, you know, well, does it make sense to talk about a real number, given that you can't write down the real number in finite time? And what if you have a machine that writes down real numbers at a constant rate, and blah, da, da, blah, da, da. And once again, we've gone beyond the confines of this lecture. So consider this a whirlwind tour of a couple of wacky things that happen in probability theory. I will comment in passing that Bayesians usually derive Kolmogorov's axioms from something else, from other axioms, I mean, you have to start somewhere, that they consider to be more plausible statements either about logic or about gambling. So the Dutch book argument is by De Finetti, and it essentially derives things that are equivalent to Kolmogorov's axioms from the demand that axiomatically we don't want to make bets where we will always lose with certainty. Cox, I don't really understand Cox's argument. It's based on the idea that probability is a form of logic, which gives me headaches. I like the analogy, but I've never fully understood the mindset. If you like logic, read Cox's book. So it's not that, you know, these axioms are not fundamental. It's just that you can treat other axioms, more physical ones, if you will, more operational ones, as fundamental. Okay. So this is sort of the end of what I'm going to talk about, philosophical interpretations. And now I'm going to start using probability to demonstrate some points. So it's perhaps a good time to pause and ask for burning questions that haven't been resolved. Doesn't mean you can't ask them later. Just means I won't answer them. So let's play with the machinery. One of the virtues of frequentism is that it's much easier as a frequentist to state certain interesting problems. So I want to talk about gambling. And I'll comment that for those of you who don't plan on a career in Wall Street, expect it anyway. For those of you who really don't plan on a career in Wall Street, gambling turns out to be essentially isomorphic to information theory, to data compression. here we are at the Institute for Quantum Computing, so information theory is somewhat relevant. So I won't go into how, but everything that I say here about gambling turns out to be directly applicable to data compression, thanks to the Kraft-Macmillan inequality, for those of you who've had a course in information theory. But let's talk about gambling instead, because I mean this is where it all started. So here's what a frequentist would say about the problem that I want to describe. We have a machine. It flips coins. Every coin that's flipped has probabilities p of getting heads and 1 minus p for getting tails. So if you're a frequentist, then you say, oh, fine, I can imagine the collective that you're talking about. If you're a propensityist, you don't even imagine a collective. I've just made a statement about your briar patch. If you're a Bayesian, then this becomes sort of a headache. So the way that you say this, we finally figured out to say this, is for every integer, for every natural number n, I can assign a probability. So n here is going to represent the number of coin flips that we will be talking about. I can assign a probability distribution over the set of all strings of length n with heads and tails. There's 2 to the n elements in that set, and to each one of them I will assign a probability. And that probability is given by the n-fold tensor product of this simple probability distribution. So the probability that I assign to heads-heads, if we happen to flip it twice, would be p squared. And the probability that I would assign to heads-tails would be p times 1 minus p. This is how a Bayesian describes this situation. Either way, we have a very simple problem here. We're going to flip a coin many times. It's got some probability. And we need to gamble on it. So here's how we play this gambling game. You can consider all sorts of other problems, other games. But this is the one that I want to consider because it's interesting. Okay, you start out with some money. Could be just, you know, $1, I think I've got it. Okay, you start out with some money, and your money is infinitely divisible. Does anyone have a hacksaw? Okay, in that case, we're going to have to imagine it. You're going to divide your money into two piles, and those piles are going to be labeled. One of them is labeled heads. I draw some pictures of coins up here, but I suck at drawing. The other one is labeled tails. And you're going to get change, and you're going to put some of your money on the heads and some of your money on the tails. And for the moment, we'll assume that your money is a real number, and you can divvy it up however you want. And then we're going to flip the coin. So if you will, imagine in your head that you have picked a fraction of your money, call it X, to put on heads, and you have picked a fraction of your money to put on tails. Go ahead. Pick. Don't tell me what it is. Just pick what it is. Okay, now I flip the coin. It came up heads. Therefore, all the money that you put on tails is now mine. Wave goodbye to your money. But however much you put on heads, I'm going to double it. How much did you put on heads? Honest people, I expected a whole bunch of all of it. Okay, so originally you put X here, and I'm going to double it, 2X. So now we can imagine playing this game again. But first, let's analyze what you should have done beforehand. So you put X of your money on heads and 1 minus X on tails. Well, we know how to use probability. What happens after the flip? We know we can say that with probability p, that was the probability of getting heads, you end up with 2x times your original money. And with probability 1 minus p, you have twice 1 minus x. Obviously, the person who made x big in that case would have done very well. The person who made x 0 is not going to get any lunch. The game is scale invariant. I never had to mention your total initial amount of money. It's not interesting, and I'm going to pretty much ignore it from now on. Whenever it shows up in the formula, don't bother looking at it. How should you play this game? Obviously, if you have certain beliefs about the coin, For instance, if you believe that the coin will come up heads every single time, then it would be foolish of you to put all your money on tails. Does anyone disagree with that? Good. Because that's a logical statement. If you know that it's always going to come up heads, you don't want to lose all your money. On the other hand, what you might do in the middle is kind of open to interpretation, especially if this is not a fair coin. If it's a fair coin, you can say, well, it doesn't matter, right? There's a symmetry argument, going all the way back to Laplace and the principle of indifference. But if it's not a fair coin, what do you do? Well, you might start by saying, I want to maximize the amount of money that I have at the end of the game. I mean, duh, don't we all? Oh, wait, you decided to go into academic physics or mathematics. Okay, let this be in publications. Forget money. You might start by maximizing your expected number of citations, which we would all love to do. Suddenly everyone perks up. That's the thing. You're still in graduate school, right? It's still fun. Trust me, if you were postdocs, you would have gotten much more excited when I said the word citations. It just sort of injects adrenaline into your spine. Almost time for a coffee break. Okay, let's work through maximizing your expected amount of money afterward. This is pretty easy. You just add up probability P. This is the average value averaged over the probability distribution of the outcome. With probability P, you have 2x. With probability 1 minus P, you have twice 1 minus x. Work, do some algebra. At the end of the day, you've got this fairly irrelevant factor out front. And then you've got a 1 minus P plus 2P minus 1 times x. And you say, okay, well, I have linear variation in my expected money with x. And I get to control x. I can't control P. So pretty obviously, if P is bigger than a half, then you maximize this by setting x equals 1 and betting all of your money on heads. If p is less than 1 half, then it means that tails are more likely, more probable, and you should bet all of your money on tails. End of story. Does anybody see anything wrong with this? Not the math, the idea. Someone.
Are we playing only once?
Does it matter? Always pleased to meet another Bayesian. It's an interesting question whether it matters or not. I sort of feel like it does, but it's hard to actually identify in the mathematics why. But let's say we're playing this game a lot. So far, I've just talked about one game. But as you notice, it's scale invariant, so you could reinvest all of your money the second time, right? You just keep doing this. There's no reason to change your strategy. Well, not if your goal is to maximize your expected money, clearly. So, let's suppose that we are going to play this game many, many times. Is there anything wrong with this strategy? Sonia, you had an answer or a question?
I was going to say, in terms of one game, there's always the possibility, which means it's probable that heads comes up, it's still possible that tails
comes up. Sure. So you could end up with $2, or you could end up with $0. You maximize your expected return. Except something odd happens. If you play this game many times, then you can work out that if you go with this all or nothing strategy, which, by the way, is known as gambler's ruin, which might tell you that there is something wrong with it, every time you either double your money or you lose it all. So let's say you start with a dollar. After one round, you have either $2 or no dollars. After two rounds, you have either $4 or no dollars. After three rounds, you have either $8 or no dollars. After that, I run out of fingers and you don't want me to take my socks off. So, under what circumstances do you have anything other than $0? That's right. As soon as you lose all your money, from that point on, you get to bet zero. Doesn't matter what you bet. You're out of the game. Bye-bye. Have a nice day. So the only way to have any money whatsoever is to win every single coin toss, which happens with probability P to the N, which is not a large number. It's an exponentially decreasing number. So what happens is that if you wait long enough, let's see. See, I'm tempted to draw this in red because it's one of those sort of oh my god things, but black is more visible. If you wait long enough, on your money scale here, there's 2 to the n up here and 0 down here, and you have 2 to the n dollars with probability p to the n, which is very, very small, and you have $0 with probability 1 minus p to the n, which is basically 1. Consider somebody, on the other hand, who had just gone completely chicken and every round bet 50-50. How does that money evolve? It's constant, because every time you lose half your money, but you double half your money. And unless your money is like different flavors, unless you've got chocolate and vanilla or something, it doesn't matter. So that person always has $1. Your expected money is much greater than that person's. But with probability approaching 1, he has more money than you. That's another one of those things that's worth thinking about on the bus sometime. So your expected money is vastly greater than that person's. But with probability approaching 1, he has more money than you. The reason is that there is a tiny, tiny probability that you have incredibly much money, and a very large probability that you'll be utterly broke. And here's a rule of thumb. Things that happen with probability approaching 1 happen. As a rule, you just don't care about things that happen with probability p to the n, as n goes to infinity and p is less than 1. So this is why this is called gambler's ruin. Okay, what this tells us is that we had a disaster by looking at that particular measure of our wealth. Coffee break. See you in 5 minutes. Walk around, get a drink, something. See you in 5 minutes, and I will explain to you the answer to everything.